Yes? Okay. Yeah. So I want to tell you about our recent work by myself and Till Barguer, Nicholas Beusert, Washington Gallias, and Florian Lobert, who are all here at the Max Planck Institute, on exacting n equals 4 superconformal symmetry. And it's exacting in that we find sort of corrections to make the symmetries more exact, but also exacting in that it puts constraints on the scattering amplitudes upon which we want to act. So it's the first thing I want to do, of course, is to talk about scattering amplitudes. And scattering amplitudes in n equals 4 SUNs, Riang-Mills, you know, they have remarkable great deal of symmetry, and they have tremendous simplicity. And so this makes them, and particularly in the limit of large number of colors, and so this makes them sort of a very attractive, you know, toy model to study, obviously with the very distant goal of more realistic physics. Although even as steps along the way, you know, sometimes you can think of n equals 4 as being sort of the simple part of QCD, or simple part of more realistic gauge theories. So as I said, I want to talk about scattering amplitudes, and in general, of course, they're functions of the external momenta, the helicities of the particles that you're scattering, and of the color. And just to start off, of course, you can write the color. You can sort of separate out the color structure by using this color decomposition, and these are the sort of partial color ordered amplitudes. And after this slide, this is always what I'm going to talk about, these sort of the color-ordered piece, and just neglect the color structure as in the leading color limit, it's always going to have sort of this form. And indeed, for most of the time, I'm only going to talk about tree level, and so this would actually be even more appropriate. So one example, and of course one of the motivating examples, of the simplicity that's actually seen in these gauge theories is this sort of interesting iterative structure that occurs sort of in all loop MHV amplitudes. And so if you take sort of a color-ordered amplitude AN and you separate out the tree piece, and so then you have sort of all the loop effects being captured by this function M of N. So here I'm thinking about sort of, again, an endpoint function. So this loop piece sort of has this very interesting sort of iterative structure. So the log of it, you have sort of the divergent pieces, the 1 over epsilon square. So the epsilon square, of course, corresponds to the fact that scattering amplitudes in 4 dimensions are going to be I or divergent. And so you have to go a little bit away from 4 dimensions. And this epsilon, of course, is that parameter and sort of controls the I or behavior of these scattering amplitudes. And so this is the leading singular piece governed by this function. Well, this is sort of the second logarithmic integral of the cusp anomalous dimension, the anomalous dimensions of which we've sort of heard so much in this conference and before. And then there's sort of the subleading I or divergent part, which is governed by the collinear anomalous dimension. Then there's a finite piece, and then there's this remainder piece. And sort of the initial sort of conjecture for the behavior of these amplitudes was that this remainder piece was actually zero, and so that these things sort of had, so that we sort of knew the all-order expression already. As it turns out, though, there's more interesting, it's not zero, so the sort of the problem is not solved. So in principle, to sort of determine the all-order scattering amplitudes for endpoint MHV amplitudes, we would just need the tree-level piece as sort of the prefactor. We would need the one-loop amplitudes, which sort of govern, for example, here. We would need the all-order cusp and collinear anomalous dimensions. And then, as I said, we would need R. We can find the cusp anomalous dimensions from an integrable model. And indeed, there's already some results for the sort of subleading IR divergent parts from the collinear anomalous dimension. And so we know that there's sort of this integrable structure, at least in part, behind these some of these coefficients that occur in these amplitudes. And you can ask, well, are there symmetries behind the other structures in the amplitude? And in particular, can we actually determine what this remainder function is? Right. And indeed, there's sort of been, of course, all this, which I imagine we will hear a good deal about more later in the conference, this dual conformal or dual superconformal invariance. I'm not going to say too much about it, but just to quickly describe it, or at least give some sort of context, you can kind of introduce dual variables which sort of solve the overall momentum constraint. So I introduce these dual variables x, and they sort of correspond to, so here P are the external momenta written in sort of this bi-spinner notation, and so I introduce these x's, and then we identify the sort of the endpoint plus one x with the sort of initial x's, imposing sort of cyclicity. And the amplitudes, of course, just only depend on the p's. So sort of trivially, they're sort of the amplitudes are going to be invariant under sort of dual translations. These x's, of course, are not actually coordinates. So they don't have, well, they're not the space-time coordinates, of course, but they are, so we don't want to think of them in that fashion, but you can sort of think of them as coordinates in sort of a dual space, and so sort of they're invariant under dual translations. But moreover than that, there's sort of the amplitudes actually transform covariantly under dual conformal transformations, conformal transformations which act linearly on the dual space variables. And furthermore, well, really, to be honest, you need to have sort of dual superconformal invariants. It's not just SO4, 2, but the full PSU 2, 2 slash 4. And so, as I said, the amplitudes transform covariantly under this symmetry. This statement, of course, is actually being a little bit sketchy. Some of these things, of course, are not proven. The dual superconformal invariance, of course, is only strictly true at tree level. There's sort of a well-known one-loop anomaly, but sort of that's... It enters in a very constrained way, and sort of you still, well, and then you will hear more about that, so I don't want to go into much. So this dual conformal invariance, it tells us, a great deal about the amplitudes. In particular, it can constrain some of these sort of the integrals that can appear at higher loops in these in loop calculations. If you look at sort of the Feynman diagrams that occur, you can sort of pick a dual diagram. So if I sort of identify the four external momenta, so if you sort of think of this on a sphere, then this X diagram, this red diagram, would actually indeed be the dual diagram sort of the black diagram. And this continues to sort of all, to more and more complicated integrals that appear in the sort of planar scattering, planar Feynman diagram calculations of scattering amplitudes. The dual conformal invariance is related to the fact that it appears that MHV scattering amplitudes are sort of, they are dual, they are also given by, they correspond to light-like Wilson loops, and this sort of has been seen perturbatively to some low orders, but it's also been sort of seen strong coupling, sort of was the original kind of noticing of it, although I guess maybe there was earlier work in sort of QCD. But in particular, via the ADS-CFT duality, we have this sort of nice description due to Alde and Maldacena of scattering amplitudes in terms of Wilson loops, strings ending on the boundary, where the Wilson loops are related to sort of the original scattering picture via this T-duality, in particular this supersymmetric T-duality where you include the fermionic T-duality that sort of maps the string model to itself. And so we have this sort of additional symmetries in the problem, and they do indeed constrain this remainder theorem, this remainder function R. But in fact, they don't fix it uniquely. So we can ask, well, is this remainder function, well, it has been shown using sort of very sophisticated generalized unitarity calculations, a sort of two loop, 6-point function, that in fact this remainder function exists, it's non-zero, it's there. And there's also sort of evidence from of the existence of this remainder function from sort of Wilson loops and from high energy scattering limits of scattering amplitudes. So indeed, as I say, there sort of is a problem, or not a problem, but there's a question. Can we actually find what this function is to determine these amplitudes? Furthermore, we have hints that there's this great deal of symmetry in this problem. So the whirl sheet theory that occurs via the Alde-Maldacena construction and sort of the ADS-CFT dual of the scattering amplitude, it's the same whirl sheet theory that you have, that we've, again, heard so much about, talking about the planar spectrum of anomalous dimensions. It's the same, there's the same sort of extended integrable algebra, this PSU 2, 2 slash 4 loop algebra that's been seen in string, the calculation of string energies. And the dual conformal invariance can actually be sort of interpreted as just a tilted embedding of the global sort of algebra inside this larger loop algebra. Also, an enlarged integrable algebra has been seen sort of for tree-level scattering, so a weak coupling. So this, of course, is the best description, of course, is a strong coupling, where we sort of have semi-classical or classical analysis of the whirl sheet theory. But at weak coupling, there's also been this by these people, Drummond, Tan, and Plefka, where they actually constructed the Yangian action on tree-level amplitudes. And so there's definite hints of an integrable structure at weak coupling, too. So can we use this integrable structure that appears to, completely, uniquely determine all scattering amplitudes? So, and as is probably apparent, the point is we need to understand the symmetry. So we would be optimistic that the symmetries would solve the problem for us. And so we, and also these symmetries have obviously been very powerful in solving for the planar spectrum. So can we sort of use the sort of the picture or the tools or the motivation that we have from integrable spin chains for local operators? Can we use these this sort of picture or tools for scattering amplitudes? And indeed, to do this, we need to sort of understand the action of the symmetry. Symmetries sort of better, even for just standard superconformal symmetries. So in some sense, this talk is sort of the zeroth part of that, where we're just going to look at the action of the sort of standard superconformal symmetries, not the dual ones, just at tree level. And we will see that even there, there sort of is a little bit of novel structure. And so to talk about these things, I'm just going to sort of briefly describe sort of the context, so that these scattering amplitudes sort of the useful description, and in particular the sort of, well, the on-shell description, but the spinner helicity formalism for massless particles. This gives sort of very extremely compact and beautiful expressions for these amplitudes. And the idea, which of course probably most people are familiar with, but just to quickly go over, is that for each light-like form momentum that corresponds to the sort of external legs of the scattering amplitudes, I can decompose it into a two-component spinner, so lambda and lambda tilde. And for 3 plus 1 signature, which is essentially for all of the talk, I'm just going to be thinking about standard 3 plus 1 Minkowski space, these spinners are related by complex conjugation. And indeed, for positive energy particles, lambda tilde is really just the complex conjugate of lambda. And this decomposition of the momenta is unique up to a phase, where I scale lambda and lambda bar, of course, in opposite directions. The sort of standard conventions that the lambda have correspond to helicity minus a half and lambda bar or helicity a half. And then given these two-component spinners, I can form Lorentz invariant invariants. Particularly, these are sort of like square roots of these sort of standard kinematical invariants where you take sums of momentum and then square them. So here I have sort of angle brackets, and this is the antisymmetric combination of two lambdas, and the square brackets, which is the antisymmetric combination of two lambda tildes or lambda bars. The on-shell content of the theory, of course, is just there's the two helicity of the two helicity states of the on-shell gluon plus and minus. There's the fermions, the four helicity half, their complex conjugates, and the six scalars. And these indices A, B correspond to the sort of SU4 R symmetry indices. And so I could take all of these states and combine them into sort of the single super wave function. And I can do this by introducing this Grassmann variable eta to write these. Well, here's my super wave function, which depends on the lambda, lambda bar, and the eta. And then I'm going to consider super amplitudes of these super wave functions. So my amplitudes, indeed, will also be combinations or will be functions in superspace. And so with this description of the amplitudes, I can write down what the PSU2,2/4 symmetries are. And here you can see, as described, the Potsdam formulation of the superconformal algebra. All I can say is the re-education camps here are very comfortable. And so these are the Lorentz generators. This is the dilatation generator, the R-symmetry. Here are the Poincaré-Suzy's, this fermionic special conformal transformations. The P is the momenta, it's just the sort of product of lambda, lambda bar, and the special conformal transformation, which is d lambda, d lambda bar. Here I'm sort of using a little bit compressed notation where the partial derivative del with a large, is this is a partial derivative with respect to eta, and this is a partial derivative with respect to lambda. We can extend this superconformal algebra into U2,2/4 by including by a central charge C, which basically just counts the number of lambdas minus the number of lambda bars minus the number of etas, and B, which is just eta C, it's the trace of eta C D eta C. And then the action of these symmetries on endpoint amplitude is just given by sort of the standard tensor product form. So I just take the sort of one site or the one particle representation and just sum over all endpoint, all the external legs on my amplitude. And the point is that it, you know, these superconformal generators should annihilate the amplitudes. Well, at certainly at tree level, but it would indeed, well, unless there's an anomaly, we would expect that the symmetries should just annihilate the amplitudes. So this is sort of what I mean by the statement that these amplitudes are invariant. I should just also mention, that there is, of course, been this construction of the sort of Yangian algebra at tree level, so it just takes sort of the standard, well, the level one part of the Yangian algebra just takes this sort of standard coproduct form where these j's are just given by the sum of sort of, you know, two j's and you sum over all possible sort of ordered products, but the important thing about checking to check this is that you have to check that it's actually consistent with the cyclicity of the amplitude. Of course, these ans, of course, are, you know, cyclically invariant, and this actually only happens due to sort of a special property of the superconformal algebra. So it's only for the superconformally invariant amplitudes that you can actually consistently or can construct this algebra. And indeed, we'll hear more about this later in the conference. The actual expressions, as I said, they take this very nice form in this spinner helicity formalism. So here is the sort of the simplest endpoint MHV gluon amplitude, where I've taken 1 and 2 to be sort of the negative helicity states, and I've taken all the rest to be, so it's mostly plus. And they just takes this nice form involving these angle brackets of products of lambdas, and there's sort of this denominator factor, and I've included an overall momentum factor, which of course is just the sum over all the individual momenta. Then you can actually kind of, as I said, this is just sort of the gluon amplitude, but I can extend and include all the particles by going to this superspace formulation. And in this case, for sort of the MHV supersymmetric amplitude, I include this super momentum conservation, which is this function Q, and then this lambda, well, Q here is given by lambda eta. More general amplitudes, you can sort of keep going. You have this very, you know, nice construction of all the tree-level amplitudes, but I can sort of take any given amplitude and factor out an overall MHV piece, and then just write this P piece, which is sort of a sum of... well, the leading piece, of course, is just 1, and then this is some polynomial in the Grassmann variable eta of sort of... increasing Grassmann degree of 4 at each step. So, for example, and then, you know, I can extract the individual component amplitudes just by taking Grassmann derivatives of this amplitude. So, for example, the gluon amplitude that I've written here is just given by eta 1 to the 4th. Eta 4, well, this is sort of the proper SU4 invariant combination of these etas, and this would be the leading term. So this particular structure of the amplitudes, one thing that really, not above and beyond just its compact form, it makes the sort of singularity structure of the MHV amplitudes particularly transparent. And it's this singularity structure of the amplitudes that's going to be very important for our story, in that it's this singularity structure that sort of is this piece of the symmetries that hasn't quite been captured. And so just to briefly describe sort of the collinear limits of the scattering amplitudes. So in general, and in the construction of scattering amplitudes at tree level and at one loop and higher, the analytic properties put very strong constraints on the amplitudes. And in particular, as sort of various kinematic invariants vanish, the amplitudes will factorize into different parts. And if we're looking just at the color-ordered part, we can only have sort of singularities as sort of adjacent or sums of adjacent momenta become null. So, for example, here I have P, and this is becoming null. And this, as I said, this just corresponds to sort of the sum of, you know, P1, P2, and so on to whatever Pn. For MHV amplitudes, they're even simpler in that they only have two particle channels, so we're sort of two adjacent. Two adjacent particles become, well, the sum of their momenta becomes null. And this is just because of sort of a conservation of helicity. You can't factorize this into sort of, there's not enough minus helicities when I try to break it into smaller pieces to make non-vanishing amplitudes. So I just need to consider the collinear limits. And moreover, it actually doesn't just split into a pole. So here I have some endpoint amplitude, and I'm considering two A and B, two adjacent states becoming collinear. So it factorizes as sort of an internal an internal state goes on shell. This is, you know, this momentum P. And so you might expect that there should be some pole corresponding to the propagator of this state, but because of sort of the angular momentum dependence of the non-trivial helicity of the gluons, in fact, actually, it doesn't split into a pole like p/1/p², but rather it develops sort of a singularity that goes like a square root of a pole, or in particular, which is, and this is the reason it's captured nicely by these spinner brackets there, sort of, you know, square roots of, as I said, of kinematical invariance. The other nice thing about these collinear limits is that this splitting is universal in that if I take any two adjacent, I take two states becoming collinear, it splits into a factor, a splitting factor here, and an endpoint, an n minus one point amplitude. But it doesn't care what this sort of amplitude is. Indeed, it's sort of the sum over all possible intermediate states. But there's sort of this universal behavior of the collinear limit. Just to say a little bit more carefully, as I said, there's two momenta, PA and PB. They're becoming equal to this momentum PP, and this is becoming null, and so this is sort of the scaling limit, and in this limit, as I said, the amplitude splits into two pieces with the splitting function given by this explicit expression here, and as I said, you find this 1 over this angle bracket. And if we want to sort of then extend this to sort of, I'm just talking about the gluon splitting factor, so this is sort of two positive helicity gluons split into a negative helicity gluon, outgoing. But if we want to extend this to superamplitude, so we kind of describe all the particles at the same time, then we have to also rescale these eta variables corresponding to the individual states. So here's my superamplitude, and so A now stands for lambda, lambda bar, also eta. And so with this scaling, the superamplitude scales in this fashion, where I replace the A and the B by just the P's as sort of the one state going into this subamplitude here, and I get this nice sort of overall factor. Okay, so that's the collinear limit. In fact, you can do better. And one nice way of studying the factorization properties of these amplitudes as sort of various kinematical regimes is to use complex momenta. And this kind of gave rise to this BCFW rules for constructing amplitudes, because not only can you actually study the analytic properties of a given amplitude, but you can find the higher amplitude or a higher endpoint amplitude from subamplitudes. And I'm not going to describe this. This is reasonably well known, and I won't need it too much. But just to very briefly describe how it works, you take two legs. So here I have some endpoint amplitude, and I want to consider it now as a function, not just of momenta, but of complex momenta. And so I take two legs here, and for the simplest case, I'm just taking two adjacent neighboring legs, and I shift their lambda and lambda tilde. I think I have one of these tildes is wrong, so that's slightly wrong. I suppose this tilde here should not be there. But nonetheless, the idea is that you shift them by this complex parameter z, and then you consider sort of the poles that occur in the amplitude, and then you sort of use Cauchy's theorem, and you find that you can write the endpoint amplitude as a sum over subamplitudes. So here, with the subamplitudes now depending on this z of p, sort of the shifted momenta. And this shifted momentum must be fixed so that the sort of intermediate state is null, so you actually can determine z of p from sort of demanding that this intermediate state it vanishes. And then this gives you sort of a nice expression for these. You also, of course, have to assume that these subamplitudes have appropriate behavior in the z-plane, in particular they have to vanish as z goes to infinity. And you can generalize this here. I guess it was originally done just for gluons, but it's straightforward to generalize it to superspace. And in that case, you basically just take, so here I have the amplitude, as I said, it's a product of two subamplitudes, and then I sum over all intermediate states. And I can take the sum and just replace it with a superspace integral, and so I get this sort of superspace version of BCF, BCFW rules. But in order to do this, I also have to it's necessary to shift the Grassmann variables too. Indeed, okay. Right. So after that very quick tour through some aspects of tree-level scattering amplitudes, I want to kind of go back to the main line of of thought, and was to see, well, what can we learn from sort of all of our experience in local operators and spin chains? Can we take any of those tools into our study of scattering amplitudes? And so it's worthwhile just to look at what at local operators, and we've seen this, of course, but it's no point, it's no harm in just reminding. So here again, I have some sort of single trace operator, this, as you would see, so it's some product of scalars making up a vacuum, and you have sort of these impurities. Here I've picked two fermionic states, and this corresponds to some spin chain, spin up and spin down being my sort of impurities. Okay, and the action of the generators on these operators is just, well, at tree level, basically it just takes a single spin site or a single lattice site and gives you back a single lattice site. This is the. But as we go to higher loops, or if we want to include, we get more complicated effects. We get sort of long range effects where the local operators, you know, reach across some number of legs and give you back some number of legs. I suppose the simplest example would just be like the dilatation operator, where you just take, say, at lowest order 2 to 2. But you can actually again have even more complicated effects where the action is actually dynamical. Sorry, so where you have, you know, two legs going to 3 or 2 legs going to 1 and so on. And indeed, this can even just occur classically, as we know from the supersymmetry generators. You know, you take a fermion into two scalars, and so you sort of get this dynamical action where you change the number of lattice sites. And I should just say, right, so and the we're going to use G as the coupling constant instead of lambda, the parameter. So here's sort of a generic generator, G. It's the sum over all the various lattice sites. And so G acts on some single trace operator. And as I said, it has various different combinations. It gets deformed. So here's the sort of the simplest, where it takes one site to one. Here's I take 1 to 2, 2 to 1, and so on. And indeed, the generators themselves can also get loop correction. So here I have sort of the one loop correction to the generator taking one site to one site. But of course, I can have loop corrections to generators also taking multiple sites to multiple sites. And in this counting of G, you can see sort of, it, you know, the here at tree level, the powers of G just correspond to sort of the number of legs that get changed. So 1 to 2 goes to the power G, 1 to 3 goes G squared. And as I said, there's also the G squared effects at, corresponding to the loop. So this is sort of the picture that we've had for some time now about scattering, about local operators. And so the idea is, well, can we extend this to scattering amplitudes. Of course, one difference is that here, this deformation, certainly as we go to loop level, is in some sense due to UV divergences of these amplitudes. And scattering amplitudes, of course, are not going to be UV divergent, but they're IR divergent. But nonetheless, there's sort of a structural similarity. So, I mean, we can always ask, well, why would we expect such a thing to happen? But there's a structural similarity just when you look at Feynman diagrams, and this is meant to be conveyed by the two pictures being very similar if I write them in this way, right? So we can kind of look at it this way. Well, we can be optimistic or whatever, but nonetheless, we can sort of expect that there will be some similarities. And so we can ask, well, what are now our expectations? What kind of are we expecting to see? Well, so the idea is that the symmetry generator on amplitudes we expect it to be deformed, so it's going to get corrections as we, you know, not necessarily in the same way as for local operators, but in some fashion. We also expect the action to be long-ranged at higher orders and to act on multiple legs, and we expect the action to be dynamical. It'll change the number of legs. So here, again, I've basically written a similar formula, but I have my free generator. I have the first dynamical generator, which takes one leg to two. So here's the picture corresponding to the action of this generator. We would expect that there's some generator which takes one leg to two. But this is a little bit confusing because then it means that the generator is not going to annihilate on the amplitude, right? Because amplitude's a fixed number of legs. I'm thinking of external physical particles. So if these things are going to change the number of legs, I need to have some sort of more complicated linear combination of amplitudes, right? So here I've put quotation marks around, but I'll say a bit more what I actually mean by this thing. But this is the idea. I'm going to take some linear combination of amplitudes which combine all of the different endpoint ones. So here I sum over the number of external legs. And of course, in principle, I can sum over the number of loops. So here I have the tree level. It acts on some loop level amplitude. It just takes 1 to 1. Here I have the the J12, which takes one leg to two legs. So here, one to two, acting, but leaves the number of loops invariant, but it changes the number of external legs on the amplitude. Here I have two to one, and this sort of adds in a loop in some sense. So I now want to consider one loop lower in my amplitude, but also one leg larger. And so you get sort of this similar pattern. And the idea is now is that it's not just that this is invariant, but this entire more complicated pattern or structure is going to be equal to zero. So I need to combine the amplitude to find the proper invariant. I need to combine the amplitudes not just with a fixed number of legs, but a larger number of legs. And so I need to have some sort of generating functional of amplitudes. And so this is what I'm going to define here. And at this point, I'm basically now just going to look at tree-level amplitudes. And so I take a generating functional of color-ordered amplitudes, and it's going to be written as a sort of a function in superspace. So here, I introduced some source that corresponds to sort of the conjugate variable to my superspace wave function. It's a function of this capital lambda here, which is what I mean by lambda. It's the sort of superspace coordinate, and I have some measure on my superspace. And, I can just find what these amplitudes are by taking functional variations of this generating functional. So here's the idea. It's just some sort of linear combination of the various endpoint functions. And I can write my free generators acting on this generation functional in a very straightforward fashion. The free representation, just, this check is the variational, check J is the variational with respect to the source, and so it just kills a leg, introduces a leg, and gives me the generator, and then I find the action of the generator on the endpoint amplitude just by integrating by parts in the normal way. So this is the free thing. I wrote it down. I've just rewritten it slightly in functional form, but I expect that there, possibly could be deformations of the form taking one leg to two. So this is sort of the sort of simplest deformation that's going to occur at tree level. And as I said, I'm only going to look at the tree level deformations at the beginning. Not only is there sort of accounting in G, but of course there's accounting in loop parameter as well, and I'm just going to focus on the tree level piece, and so I'm just going to look at these J zeros. Right, so, first of all, of course, this is all very great, good and motivating, these things, but we actually want to show that they occur. So the important thing is that I want to show that the tree-level amplitudes are not actually invariant, and indeed we'll see that they're not, and for sort of a well-known reason in some sense. Then I'm going to write these variations in terms of the generation functionals so that I can write down a correction to my generator that acts on a different endpoint amplitude such that I find invariance under this linear combination. And that's all sort of a constructive method in order to define these things. But the question remains, of course, is that, are these deformed generators, do they still respect the superconformal algebra? And this is non-trivial, so this is an important thing to check. Okay, but the first thing is to find the deformation. So we take our endpoint MHV amplitude, we just consider to start with the S bar zero, the special superconformal, a special conformal fermionic special conformal generator. Right, and so we remember that these spinner brackets are holomorphic functions of the lambda. Well, they just basically only depend on the lambdas. So the only dependence of the of the MHV amplitude on lambda bar is just through this momentum delta function. So the amplitudes are holomorphic functions of the lambdas except for the argument of the delta function. So here I just look at the action of S bar on A and MHV. So this is the expression for S bar. It's just dd lambda bar multiplied by eta. And the only thing that it's going to act on is the momentum delta function. And so I can replace this dd lambda bar with a lambda. And so I get this sum lambda eta. And then this, with respect, and then there's a derivative of the delta function. But this linear combination just vanishes because of the supermomentum conservation. So here I have this, this linear combination of lambda and eta is vanishing because of this delta function, so this thing vanishes. So this, the action of S bar on A vanishes. So this was in I'm not sure who originally showed it, was in this paper by Witten in 2003. But this is a little bit too fast. There's actually an anomalous contribution, which was also noticed by CSW, which is sort of the form that if I take, the derivative of 1 over z with respect to z bar, I actually find a delta function sort of localized where z is equal to 0. And this is sort of the holomorphic anomaly that was called by these people. And this gives rise to corrections or to extra terms in this calculation where dd lambda acts on this product of anti-symmetric products of lambdas. So in particular, dd lambda bar acting on 1 over this spinner bracket gives me a delta function times a prefactor. And this delta function then has this sort of interesting structure where basically it tells me that the momenta corresponding to lambda and mu are basically become collinear. So this is saying that sort of the holomorphic anomaly corresponds to sort of collinear limits of these amplitudes. And we have to include this effect. So we can kind of go through the calculation, including this anomalous contribution. So S bar acting on AMHV now gives me this sort of non-trivial term. And I can write this thing. I can evaluate the collinear, the delta function imposing collinearity. I can write this in terms of the generating functional for endpoint MHV amplitudes after evaluating this delta function. And I find this sort of nice form. So I find, first of all, so here's S bar acting on the generating functional for MHV amplitudes. There should be no N here. This is for... Oh, no, this is the N piece. Okay. So acting on it, I find this integral over superspace. I get this prefactor where I've sort of evaluated these the lambda 1 and lambda 2. So I just consider sort of the collinear limit of two parts. And I consider where lambda 1 goes like lambda sine alpha, lambda 2, lambda cosine alpha. I have to make a rescaling of these etas. And so after doing this, I find that this action gives me this sort of prefactor corresponding to leg 1 and an n minus 1 point amplitude. So this is sort of suggestive that I can actually introduce a correction acting on the endpoint n minus 1 point amplitude, that will cancel this term. And indeed, that's exactly what you can do. You can look at the deformation of the S bar, which I've now called S bar plus, which has this form. Basically, it acts on the generating functional. This is J check. It kills 1, it inserts 2, and it multiplies by this prefactor. And acting on the generating functional, this will exactly cancel the sort of anomalous term that I find. So this is what we find. We find, as I just said. So now, at tree level, this S bar acting on the generating functional, which I've now included all endpoint ones, is indeed invariant. And so it sort of changes the number of legs, and it changes sort of the helicity charge. Where here I've defined the helicity charge. So k is the eigenvalue of this generator B, which if you remember is eta d eta, and it changes this combination twice the number of points minus 4 times this k by 2. And it sort of, as I said, reduces sort of, the number of legs as you go down, and you get this recursive structure, where in particular, G plus acting on the 4-point function sort of just gives you 0. So it's sort of the recursive structure goes all the way down as you go from, various different legs until it hits the 4-point, and then it just gives you 0. And this is just for the very simple reason that in some sense the 3-point MHV amplitude for real momenta is just 0 because there's 0 phase space allowed. You can do the same thing for S by looking at MHV bar amplitudes, and you find in this case a correction, again, of a very similar form, but which increases K by 1. So it sort of decreases this charge by 2. And you can also, calculate the similar corrections to K, where again you find now a plus part, a minus part, and a slightly more complicated part, which is sort of... takes sort of 2 legs. Actually, you can just find this just from the algebra of S and S bar, but you can directly calculate it too. And at this order, the sort of dilatation and the Poincaré generator and the Suzy's are just uncorrected. So this is sort of our exacted conformal exacted representation of the generators. Okay. So at this point, we were just looking at MHV and MHV bar amplitudes, but of course you want this thing to be exact for all amplitudes, and so you would want to consider sort of a generic amplitude. So here's an endpoint, and I'm going to label the amplitude by k, so it has this sort of helicity charge 4k. So by this sort of the MHV is n comma 2, and the MHV bar is n minus 2, and I have a generic generator, which again it has sort of 1 leg to 1 leg, 1 to 2, 1 to 2, but this is sort of the minus piece where it changes the helicity charge by 2, and then a 1 to 3 in principle, This is this J plus minus piece. And the statement would be that for an arbitrary two-level amplitude, the generators, the exact generators, should annihilate this linear combination of all amplitudes. And so just to say again, combining these different effects, I sort of find this nice recursive structure, which starting with the four-point MHV, I can go by sort of J plus to A52 or by J minus to A53, and this sort of, you know, work my way through the entire set of sort of amplitudes. Now, the idea that this, so of course, I only constructed these things by looking at MHV and MHV bar, but given that they arise from collinear singularities, which are known to be universal, we can expect that the action should apply to generic amplitudes. And you can then check this. So sort of we can start with one specific example, sort of the NMHV amplitude. And so this is explicit expressions for this are actually known in terms of I have the MHV prefactor, and then I have sort of corrections in R, which are dual superconformal invariants. And in principle, this idea could break down in that there could be additional corrections to my generators from other anomalous terms. In principle, there could be corrections from multiparticle singularities, where sort of larger, multiple momenta become null. However, you can easily check that these will not actually contribute. There could also be sort of, if you look at explicit expressions, there appear to be spurious singularities, and these spurious singularities look like they might need to be accounted to, but they are actually spurious. And if you get the proper expression for your amplitude, you'll actually see that they're not there. So you can calculate the action of S and, say, S bar on NMHV, and you can find that the same deformation as was found previously works in this case, too. And moreover, you can actually... you can kind of go to a sort of generic endpoint amplitude. And if I assume a particular scaling in the collinear limit, so here I've written down the appropriate scaling for an, k to go to an minus 1k, and here's the an minus 1 to k minus 1. So these are the sort of the various collinear limits of this amplitude as 1 becomes collinear with 2. I get two sort of singular pieces with these prefactors. So here I'm looking at this particular scaling of lambda 1 and lambda 2, and also scaling eta 1 and eta 2. I get this particular form. If I have this form, it's pretty straightforward, and no other singularities, it's pretty straightforward to actually show that S bar will, that the deformations that we found in the earlier cases account for all the singularities in that they annihilate in exactly the same way. And you can actually show this using the BCF recursion relations in superspace formulation. You can actually show that sort of this scaling does occur. You can sort of use a standard, reasonable inductive scaling argument. And in some sense, this is not too surprising. As I said, really all you're doing is sort of demonstrating the universality of collinear limits, which is well known, of the splitting functions via the BCF W relations. So just to go back, that's forward. So that's the argument, but yes. Okay. That's the argument that sort of general amplitudes will be annihilated by the exactly deformed generators. And we can ask, well, this expression for these NMHV endpoint amplitudes is given sort of, this, so not just for the 6-point, but for any point, is given by this overall prefactor and then the sum of dual superconformal invariants. And so the form of this amplitude is fixed, or I should say the form of these R's are fixed by dual superconformal invariants, but the coefficients are not. And you can ask, well, what fixes these coefficients? Is there some other symmetry? And the point is that these coefficients have to take the values that they do, or else the extended, the deformed generators would not annihilate. And that's just to say that if they did not take this form, well, there would be spurious singularities, and the collinear limits would not be correct, and so the exact generators would not annihilate. And indeed. This was actually shown that sort of these amplitudes take this unique form if you assume that they have the proper collinear limits, or they have an absence of spurious singularities by Korchemsky and Sokachev. So that they showed that indeed these amplitudes are not fixed uniquely by the dual conformal invariants, but are fixed by the proper analytic properties of these three-level amplitudes. But in our language, we can sort of turn it around and say that these amplitudes are fixed. They are they, these these amplitudes are exactly fixed by the exact generators, and this is the exacting part, in that they are fixed by the exact symmetries, in essentially for the same reason, but in a slightly different language. Then, just to... that's the wrong slide. So this is sort of the constraints that are put on the amplitude by... I'm almost done, so I'll just finish up. But just to say that you can actually check that the deformed algebra does indeed close. So here's, for example, I can take the anticommutator of S with S, and this, of course, should be 0. But now the free part, of course, we know just vanishes. S0 with S0 vanishes. But there's going to be a correction with S0 with S minus, and here symmetrized over these indices. And to evaluate it, I can act on a source term. And you can calculate this bracket, and after a little bit of algebra, you find that it doesn't vanish. And that's a bit perplexing, but you can then check, well, one thing I have to make use of is I have to make use that on physical states, the central charge has to vanish. So I get sort of one relation that I can use in evaluating this, and this makes sense, that the physical states should indeed have the proper scaling weight under phase shifts of the arguments. And so you can use this, and you, after a little bit more algebra, you can keep going, and you find that still doesn't vanish. But what actually happens is that the resulting term of S0 with S minus just looks like a commutator acting on J. And this is just a gauge transformation. It's a field-dependent gauge transformation, which just takes my source into the commutator of J with some parameter X. So if I define my gauge transformation, the generator of my gauge transformations as such, so it sort of acts on my my cyclically invariant amplitudes, and just by taking commutators with respect to some parameter, then I find that the algebra closes up to gauge transformations. And this is in some sense, first of all, it's similar to as was found in local operators. You can check all the other anticommutators, and they're indeed also the same. So then just the last thing I want to say, and this is actually not different, but it's, of course, that this, as I said, this holomorphic anomaly has occurred before in the study of tree-level and one-loop MHV scattering amplitudes, as was pointed out by CSW. And these amplitudes have this sort of nice, interesting behavior in twister space, which can be sort of analyzed by studying sort of the... So, for example, in twister space, MHV amplitudes look like they lie on a single line, and, one-loop amplitudes can, they lie on unions of lines, or indeed they should, but if you actually look carefully, it looks like that's not true. And you can convert this sort of collinearity statement into the fact that amplitude should be annihilated by a certain generator. And as such, this is sort of the momentum representation of the twister space collinearity. But of course, this expression should also have an anomaly. And you have to account for this anomaly. So if you look at sort of the unitarity cut of one-loop amplitudes, you can show that you have to include the holomorphic anomaly to incorrectly interpret this collinearity behavior. And indeed, this is true for the full amplitude, as the amplitudes should be cut constructible. And just maybe interestingly, did this collinearity operator actually appeared recently, or it appears to be perhaps related sort of to the action of S bar on tree level amplitudes. There may be nothing or may not be, but it's certainly interesting. And moreover, Cachazzo and BCF made very nice use of this holomorphic anomaly to actually determine to determine the coefficients of one-loop amplitudes when you write them in terms of scalar box integrals. But I won't go into that. I just wanted to mention it. Okay. So this is then my conclusions. This is what I've said. I won't repeat it. And of course, there's sort of this was really, of course, just the beginning, right? We want the first thing we want to do is go to one loop. I mean, with local operators, this picture of deformed generators proved so useful in determining the full problem now, which we've made great progress to solving. We'd also like to include the Yangian symmetries and the dual conformance symmetries. As I said, everything I was talking about was just the simplest case. There's questions about other signatures and twister space description. Of course, this is the end goal is to determine the amplitudes completely. And then, as a sort of a side remark, you could also ask, well, given the relationship between n equals 4 amplitudes and n equals 8 amplitudes, can we use the symmetries in that case? And it should be said that nothing I said at tree level depended on the planar limit or anything like that. So you could ask maybe there's certain similar things. Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, any questions?
here.
You have seen the linear singularity.
Yes.
But there are regular singularities also in principle. What is follows from this?
Okay, so it's
amplitudes from regular factorization.
Yes. Okay, so I don't know the answer. It seems that at the level that we were looking at, it's only the collinear singularities that give rise to these anomaly terms, and the other singularities you would they don't give rise to they don't give rise to such anomalies. You might need some sort of different prescription to actually see them. They give you sort of a different codimension constraint on these amplitudes, and so you would need some sort of different prescription for including them. And so you could imagine that there would be different deformations of these generators that might capture certain singularities, but I don't know what they would look like. And they don't seem to be necessary, at least as we looked at them. Here.
So my question is the
same. Okay.
Question.
There's a question back there.
Yes. You said at the very beginning that you want to at the end to want to use the symmetry to constrain the Riemannian function.
I'm sorry.
At the very beginning, you said that one of the goals of this construction was just to constrain the Riemannian function.
Yes. Yes.
And we know the Riemannian function vanishes in the collinear limit.
The part that we know already, like the part that's given by the BDS, has all the right collinear limits, and that's true. Yes. So my claim is not that what we have found here tells you anything about that remainder function. The idea would just be that if we understand the symmetries of the problem, including say the integrable structures, the Yangians, that they might tell you something about this remainder function. But the point is that in order to look at the Yangians, you have to understand even just the simplest part, and so that's what this is.
Okay, but then brings me to the second question that you know automatically it's going to the loops. Once you start including loops, you know you'll have divergences. Divergences means you go away from critical dimensions. You see, you will be defined away in four dimensions.
Yes.
Once you go away from four dimensions, you're losing every symmetry you had from the very beginning. The question is what you're hoping for.
Okay. It may not work, but all I would say is that you might hope that you can include all of the appropriate effects that you lose by sort of going away from the critical dimension by appropriately deforming these generators such that they do satisfy the same algebra. But I don't know that this is actually possible.
But once you go away from four dimensions, the first thing that will happen, beta function will be different from zero. So are you saying you want to deform generators so you kill beta function?
So I don't know how it's going to work, and so I can't tell you. I guess, as I said, I would just hope that you could deform the generators such that you find some... that you preserve the algebra, you preserve some structure... without having to address those sorts of issues. But I don't know how it's going to work.
And you also wouldn't expect it to work for all epsilon, for generic dimension. You would only expect it to work up to epsilon to the zero, up to the finite bit. You wouldn't think you go further.
I guess one way you could hope, I mean, of course, the amplitudes themselves will depend on epsilon, but you could hope that the deformed generators don't depend on epsilon.
Well,
obviously not answering your question sufficiently then, so maybe
maybe I'll comment a question that at the end of the day, this object that you're discussing, it's not a physical quantity. Okay, the amplitude
right.
It doesn't exist in the niche, it vanishes. Actually, if you remove epsilon, the amplitude goes to zero.
Right.
So therefore, in the first approximation, it's a good question to ask to construct physical quantity and then discuss this issue for the physical quantities, like
you
total
like
cross-sections.
Sections or something like this?
Like differential cross-sections, total cross-sections.
Okay.
Perhaps we can leave that for discussion later on and move to the next talk. So let's thank our speaker again.